From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. On this week's show, we visit some area communities where a certain big box store is causing a big stir, either because it's coming in.
Is South Lee Summit becoming safer and more secure? Is this allowing for high-quality, upscale development? Or is it simply likely to be a more profitable location for Walmart to locate there?
Or leaving.
You know, they're leaving us and they're just going like a mile away or whatever.
Plus the story of a local businessman who became a spiritual leader in an international religious organization.
And James Lynn said for the first time in his life he realized that his hands were completely still.
And hear about the end of a long-standing Kansas City institution.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. We've covered the issue of food deserts on our show before. The term refers to neighborhoods without access to affordable, healthy foods. But there's some places where people are up in arms over the potential arrival of a grocery store, particularly when that store is Walmart. On today's show, we'll drop in on a couple of communities that are debating the drawbacks and benefits of having the world's largest retailer as a neighbor.
Last Thursday night, a group of residents showed up at the Lee's Summit City Council meeting wearing red to oppose the construction of a $25 million Walmart supercenter. The proposal would bring a second Walmart to Lee's Summit, about 5 miles south of the existing store. During the meeting, developers focused on the energy-efficient specifications of the new building, and council members asked a lot of questions about the potential traffic snarls that could arise once thousands of cars showed up on this mostly undeveloped tract of land by Highways 150 and Southwest Market Street. But residents had other concerns. Here are some voices from that meeting.
Walmart simply does not spur the high-quality development that we and the city would like to see in that area. And that is evidenced by the surrounding establishments around the current Walmart. You have a lot of fast food, the dollar store. That's not the kind of development we want to see in our area.
Several years ago, Walmart built a store in Belton, there west or east of 71, just north of 58. After they built it, the whole area in Belton and Raymore started expanding, and I mean expanding big time. Then Walmart had to move southeast across Caddy Corner, across the road into Raymore to get a bigger store to be able to help, you know, handle the merchandise for the people. Since that time, the city of Raymore and Belton and that whole area out there, the development has really grown.
There are actually three Walmart supercenters within 10 to 15 minutes of where we're located. There is one in Harrisonville. The other concern I have with a Walmart location tends to be Walmart moves into a location, stays there for a few years, and then moves to a different location. We experienced that here in Lee Summit with the Third and Ward location that is now a Hy-Vee when they moved to the north. Blue Springs, I believe, still has an empty Walmart. Harrisonville has an empty Walmart location. Belton has an empty Walmart location as they have moved to different locations. So that's my concern. With that much retail space, we already have retail locations in that part of town that do not have tenants currently. And I'm concerned that new tenants won't move into those locations fearing that they have to compete with Walmart.
I am just asking you tonight, if this goes through, do not make the mistake that other city councils have made by not ensuring that if a Walmart were to close in Lee Summit, whether the one up there off of Tudor or the one here, that we don't have this same situation where a building sits empty and it's only used in case of a disaster with a tornado or whatever. Please make sure that they take care of that building and it does not sit there and grow weeds and grow rats.
I would like to thank Walmart for bringing their application forward. I welcome all investment in the community and the desire of Walmart to place a second store in Lee Summit. Suggest to me that Lee Summit is seen as a vibrant and growing community. I also appreciate that Walmart is not asking for any kind of tax incentive in this application.
By this development, is South Lee Summit becoming safer and more secure? Is this allowing for high-quality, upscale development? Or is it simply likely to be more profitable location for Walmart to locate there?
I understand totally where the people are coming from. On the other hand, as a city council member, I understand the need for the sales tax.
The Mormons own the land north of us. You can't do anything with it. You can't get any taxes from that except farmland. And I know what I'm paying for farmland. It ain't much for taxes. And I hear that that's for the second coming, the land. And if God comes over here and sees there's no Walmart, he probably won't stay. So thank you very much.
The proposed South Walmart will be less than 1 mile from Trail Ridge Elementary, Summit Lakes Middle School, and a couple of daycares. While we are unsure how these entities will be affected, our concern is with the correlation of crime and Walmart within such a short distance from these types of organizations.
Because Walmart generates a lot of calls for service, it's the number one call generator in for the police department, there is the natural inclination that there's a lot of crime at Walmart. And when people think there's a lot of crime at Walmart, you automatically think of serious crimes, assaults, and robberies. So by drilling down the numbers, drilling down into the incidents, you see that serious crime is less than 1%, or actually in our case, in Lee Summit, 0.5% is serious crime. So I think the fear comes from the fact, a black and white fact, that the police are at Walmart a lot. And when the police are at Walmart a lot, you think, geez, Walmart has a big crime problem. If you drill into the statistics, you see the police are at Walmart a lot, mainly because Walmart security catches a lot of shoplifters. They catch a shoplifter, they call us, we go out there and make the arrest.
That last voice was the chief of police in Lee's Summit. The city council ended up postponing a decision until they get more information about potential traffic patterns around the proposed Walmart. As the debate rages in Lee's Summit, residents of Waldo are also talking about the possibility of a Walmart neighborhood market moving in. That's Walmart's version of a grocery store, not a big supercenter. This would be at the site of an old school building, which closed back in 2001. I went down there last week to check it out. Bingham Junior High School is a low-slung, yellow brick building. Some of the windows are boarded up and there's graffiti on the walls. The front of the building faces a residential block, but it backs up onto the trolley track trail and Mornell, right across from a Goodyear tire center. The school district began a real push to sell or lease old schools when it closed about 30 of them a couple of years ago. The district's repurposing team asked community members what they wanted to see happen to the Bingham School property, and most agreed that a commercial use would be okay. In fact, the community seemed on board with a recent proposal for a henhouse grocery store in that spot until the proposal fell through. Angie Lyles is a business owner and on the board of the Tower Homes Association in Waldo.
I drive by there almost every single day because I live very close to that property. So every time I drive by, there's lots of kids, families out. You know, it seems like that the fields are used quite a bit.
Like a lot of other residents, Lyles admits she wasn't paying much attention to the repurposing process of the Bingham School until Walmart came along.
The way I see it, it was the catalyst. And I can almost thank Walmart for that because it really got people to thinking about what they wanted to see in that space, where before they were just seeing the blight, the empty building, and the eyesore. And so there are many people who are in support of the store because they really want to get rid of that eyesore. They don't want that anymore. They don't want the blighted building. They want something to be done. They're tired of waiting. And I can understand that. However, over the course of going against Walmart, a lot of other people have come forward with the same feelings. And they actually have resources. They know how to get financing. And they see a community use for that property just as much as I did. So it's almost like we all kind of got fired up.
Lyles started a Facebook group, Waldonians Against Walmart, which now has more than 1,500 members. Incidentally, she says she had to misspell Walmart with two L's because you can't start a Facebook group with the name Walmart in the title. Lyle says she doesn't like Walmart's business practices. Others are concerned about how the store will compete with local businesses, or that it would bring a lot of traffic to a spot that's more residential. Other residents see that spot as commercial already and would welcome Walmart's low prices on groceries.
Revisions have continued to be made to the proposal based on the feedback that we've received from the business community and the neighborhood associations.
Shannon Jacks runs the repurposing department of the Kansas City School District. She says Walmart has agreed to limit its hours and contribute to the community improvement district. Jacks says if there seems to be some community agreement on the proposal, it will go to the school board for a vote, and then the city council will need to rezone that plot of land.
Meanwhile, in northeast Johnson County, two suburban cities were competing for Walmart to be their tenant. KCUR's Suzanne Hogan tells us how the move of one Walmart is impacting two communities divided by Johnson Drive.
I walked the 0.8 mile down Roe Avenue from where Walmart lives now to where it's going to call home on Roe and Shawnee Mission Parkway. It's going to be part of the Mission Gateway development, expected to open in fall of 2014. This Walmart in Mission will close the Walmart in Roland Park, which has been there since 1996. The walk was full of busy Roe Avenue traffic, well-kept homes. The whole thing took about 10 minutes. At the corner of Roe Avenue and Johnson Drive, facing Shawnee Mission Parkway, if you look to the north side of the street, you see Roland Park. There are sparsely inhabited businesses, including a cremation center and weight loss store, facing a dirt-filled lot covered in weeds on the Mission side of Johnson Drive. This empty lot will be the new Walmart, but it's this current stark scenery that has had residents and retailers on both sides of Johnson Drive anxious.
I'm just tired of all the fuss here, you know? I mean, something needs to happen.
Thomas Harris's law firm is one of the businesses on the Roland Park side of the street. He lives in Mission, but works and owns property in Roland Park.
And I've got mixed emotions about it all because of my, you know, residents in both places and having sat here and looked at this vacant lot for how many years now.
This lot used to be Mission Mall. In 2004, revisions to the FEMA floodplain map put the property Mission Mall sat on in a floodplain. There were major renovations needed to keep up the property. Around that time, Walmart stepped in and offered to build a Super Walmart store there. But the residents of Mission rejected the plan, saying they wanted the location to house a mixed-use property.
Essentially, the city said, look, you know, if you're going to put a discount department store, it can't be more than 50,000 square feet per level unless you're going to do a multi-level garage parking, and we really want to see more than that on the properties.
Tom Valenti is the managing member of the Gateway Developers of the Cameron Group. They ended up purchasing the land and demolished the mall in 2006, launching their plans for the Gateway Mixed-Use Development Project. While the city of Mission invested about $12 million in stormwater improvements for the property, the developers mapped up a vision for the corner. But the plan has been taking a lot longer than expected.
2007, when the condominium market went away because there was no more financing for condominiums, you know, we looked at converting the residential to multifamily rental units. In 2007 and 2008, when the economy turned even worse, you know, we were looking for alternative means of financing. We came up with the potential of including the aquarium and a hotel in the project.
That's right, an aquarium, 2 to 4 times bigger than the one in Crown Center, with talks of possible scuba diving classes. It was to be a regional attraction, part of a plan to use STAR bonds, a sales tax revenue bond offered to Kansas municipalities for major commercial entertainment and tourism areas. And there were still more spaces to be filled.
In 2010, when retailers were still not doing very much, we looked at increasing the office component of the project to a much greater extent. By August 2011, it was clear that that wasn't working. We hadn't signed a tenant yet. And lo and behold, Walmart came to us.
Now, even though Walmart came to them, STAR bonds are supposed to be used for bringing in new businesses, not as incentives for businesses to move from one Kansas town to another. And Roland Park didn't want to lose their Walmart, which is their number one tax generator. Valenti couldn't secure the STAR bonds, which got rid of the aquarium and hotel plan. But Walmart stayed on board. Walmart became the key element in securing and expediting the development's plans. It agreed to be part of a community improvement district, paying taxes with other retailers to bring in financing for the project. Valenti says there's been a lot of compromising.
You know, the city wanted an organic grocer in addition to the organic product that Walmart would provide. So, you know, the city really wanted that and was helpful with us in making sure that Walmart understood that we needed to have that kind of a retailer in here.
The Gateway development has secured Sprouts Organic Grocery Store, Toby Keith's Bar and Grill, Aspen Fitness Center, and they're still looking for more retailers. There will also be 300 residential units.
I'm telling you that the outside of this building doesn't look like any Walmart I've ever seen.
This 150,000-square-foot Super Walmart won't be made of cement blocks. It will be on the bottom level of a multi-level building with its own parking, but surrounded by other retailers.
Like along Johnson Drive, it will have storefront in it. The storefront will carry murals. There'll be a community message board and special lighting. You know, there's nothing like this, especially with another grocer, especially with residential. I think this is pretty unique.
Roland Park has known Walmart was looking for a bigger retail space since 2004. Walmart had received tax increment finance incentives when it first came to Roland Park Shopping Center in 1996, but the spot was never built as a Walmart, which made it kind of a smaller hybrid-style Walmart store. Even though Roland Park made offers to improve on-site facilities, move tenants, make more room, Walmart turned them down. Which bums Roland Park out, not because of any personal love for the Walmart Corporation as a neighbor necessarily, though there might be some of that, but mostly because they'll be missing out on the sales tax dollars.
Somebody's got to get the tax dollars, you know.
Roland Park resident Teresa Boydston is on a walk too. Roland Park will lose $700,000 in sales tax dollars when Walmart leaves, which is no small number when your annual budget is $5.5 million. She says it's frustrating to be missing out.
You know, they're leaving us and they're just going like a mile away or whatever.
Though the loss of tax dollars is bothersome, Roland Park knows that if the Gateway development in Mission is a success, that it could create economic perks for the community as well.
It's going to be a benefit for the region. I'm disappointed that, you know, Walmart's leaving, unfortunately. They've been a good tenant, but I hope that project works out well.
Aaron Otto is the city manager of Roland Park. He says the success of the project could lead to higher property values and more people shopping at businesses on Row on their way to the development someday. But that day is not here yet.
13 is funded as we anticipate. So it's 14. The next budget we work on is when we start seeing those decline in revenues where decisions need to be made.
Those decisions mean cuts. And though there's talks of how this could impact the city's community center, police department, infrastructure, and other services, the exact impacts won't be known until the city council drafts its 2014 budget this spring. For Casey Currents, I'm Suzanne Hogan. Coming up, hear how Walmart is starting to stock local produce in its stores. You're listening to Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Now, how about Walmart's commitment to local food? Back in 2010, Walmart announced it would double the amount of local produce it sold in stores by 2015. 2 years early, the company's already exceeded that goal and now claims to source 11% of its produce sold in the U.S. from local farms. Walmart defines local as grown and sold in the same state. To understand how this is playing out in the Midwest, Harvest Public Media reporter Abby Fentress Swanson talked with Ron McCormick, the Senior Director of Sustainable Agriculture for Walmart's U.S. division.
Thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome.
First, tell me how Walmart sources 11% of its produce nationally from local farms.
Abby, we buy local product, which is essentially, we define that as product grown and sold in the same state in a variety of ways. We have 8 local buyers whose job it is to buy as much local as they can for our stores in particular states. So they're looking for the opportunities. And they in particular work with our smaller farmers, direct farmers and suppliers. We have some product that goes directly to our stores where we set up the small farmer and the small farmer talks to someone, to the produce manager in the store and arranges deliveries. And then a large chunk of the product that we buy locally is sourced by our global food sourcing team, which has offices around the world. So we have offices from the global food sourcing team in Florida, Texas, California, and Washington State, because there is, of course, so much U.S. production in those states. And they buy for our U.S. business, and then they also buy for other Walmart markets.
One of the things I know when you guys announced this initiative in 2010 was that you wanted to use small and medium-sized farms to help source this local produce initiative. And I'm wondering what the challenges are to getting small and medium-sized farms to be suppliers for the program.
There's a whole series of challenges for small farmers to do business with big buyers like Walmart or some of the food service companies or even the government. One of the big problems is simply the fact that you're buying lots of dollars worth of product from lots of people. So being able to communicate with large numbers of farmers is a challenge for everyone. For small farmers, too, there is a lot of, you know, so much of their time is by necessity spent on the tractor and on the farm that they don't have a lot of time to do some of the other things that are necessary, kind of the red tape things for big farmers. So just time issue and trying to cut through red tape that are there for various reasons to help the small farmer be able to do business with us is a challenge. And then from a practical perspective, too, you know, one of the advantages of doing business with a big national grower is that if they have rain or hail on a field, they simply ship us the product from another location or another field where they're growing, and we don't see the problem that the farmer's enduring as a buyer. But if you're dealing with a small farmer and they have that problem, it rains today and they can't get out in their field to harvest the watermelons, they don't have an option where they can go and buy the product. So it essentially creates a problem for a big buyer in the surety of supply. So that is an obstacle that always has to be planned for, and you have to have some contingency plans so that it works. And as all of us are getting more interested in and understanding the need to be conscious about food safety, some of the things, the simple things that farmers have to do to ensure food safety, if you're not spreading that cost over lots of dollars and lots of production, it's difficult for it to make financial sense. So have to be sure that we're working with small farmers in a way that they can ensure food safety, that they are doing the right things, getting the, you know, the necessary audits and doing the best practices that would protect our customers. You also have to be conscious of the cost. And there are ways to help the farmer with those costs and ways to reduce the cost. But it, again, is a matter of doing that hundreds of times over if you're working with small farmers. One of the big costs are audits, as an example. So if a small farmer arranges an audit on their own, it essentially you pay for the auditor's travel. So that small farmer has a big expense for their audit. And one of the ways that we help avoid that is we coordinate our plans with lots of farmers and try to have the auditor come in and do an entire area while they're there. And then those kind of fixed costs of the trip can be spread out over lots of growers and lots of dollars, which makes it cheaper for the small farmers. There's a whole series of those things that are a problem.
So given these challenges, have you sort of changed your business model so you're supplying more produce from large farms than what you had initially planned back in 2010?
I think we're doing really actually with more small farmers. We've been working with the USDA Office of Advocacy Outreach and five land-grant universities in the Southeast, especially with the leadership from Tuskegee University, on kind of a pilot program to try to help create a new business model for small farmers, which is in some degrees not new. It's really about farmer cooperatives, so that a cooperative of small farmers can do business as a business unit, and that makes it easier for them to do business with big suppliers. And the dean of the School of Agriculture at Tuskegee, Dr. Walter Hill, has been working on funding for a new facility kind of in Dallas County outside Selma that we hope is also a model for a new business model for small farmers. It's a sort of food hub concept that would make infrastructure and resources available to small farmers in a different way than they tend to find those resources today.
Okay, and are you planning more of those sort of food hubs?
The hope would be that we can show such success with this pilot that lots of other organizations and other people would be willing to kind of join that effort, and that those types of facilities would spread in lots of states with high potential for local production. Because the biggest obstacle for a small farmer to really build a long-term sustainable business is that they just don't have the infrastructure available to them that a grower in some place like Salinas, California would have. And because the infrastructure is not there, it's not efficient and not handy, and getting the services that come from that infrastructure tend to be either impossible to get or very expensive for a small farmer. So putting some infrastructure in place is really the secret to developing kind of a regional agricultural economy that can sustain itself.
I've spent some time here in the Midwest trying to find small farms that you've been doing business with, and I did find one in Kansas. But other than that, all of the farms I've talked to who are suppliers for Walmart are large. And even on your website, the farms that you highlight, the majority of them are very large by the Department of Agriculture standards. So I guess I'm just having a hard time believing that you're working with more small farms.
So Addie, part of the problem that you're encountering is where you're looking. Kansas and Nebraska are probably two of the states where, because this is essentially a produce initiative at this point in time, you're not going to find the small farmers there that we would do business with. We do more business in lots of other states where there are lots of small farmers that are doing specialty crops, which is what you'd find in a produce department. So looking in Kansas, where the meat industries and things like corn and soybeans are the big ag products there, you're going to look hard to find small growers that we're doing business with. And we wouldn't be there spending a lot of our time trying to grow it when you can go to Alabama, Mississippi, Illinois, Indiana, New York, Pennsylvania, Texas, many states where the number of small farmers are so much greater than they would be in a place like Kansas. And one of the reasons working with the USDA, we focused on our pilots in five southeastern states, is because, for a variety of reasons, but one of the reasons was because there was such a high concentration of very small underserved farmers in Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, and Texas, which were the pilot states. But you won't find us spending a lot of time in Wyoming trying to find small cabbage growers, and you won't see us spending a lot of time in Kansas, unfortunately, simply because they don't exist, which doesn't mean at some point in the future we wouldn't love to encourage that development. We have a warehouse in Nebraska that has probably our smallest percentage of locally grown product, because unless you're in the meat business or something other than specialty crops, you're not going to find the small growers there that are able to do business with a big customer.
Got it. Well, thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome.
Ron McCormick is the Senior Director of Sustainable Agriculture for Walmart's U.S. division. He spoke with Harvest Public Media's Abby Fentress Swanson. We continue the conversation about Walmart Tuesday morning on Central Standard. I'll be hosting a show in which we explore the retailer's impact on local communities.
Kansas City is the home base for several big religious organizations, like the Church of the Nazarene and the Community of Christ Latter-day Saints Church. But our city can also boast being the hometown of a saint. The Self-Realization Fellowship is an international meditation group with roots in India, and SRF recognizes a late Kansas City business tycoon as one of its greatest yogis and spiritual masters. Alex Smith has a story of a man who made dollars by day and karma by night.
On a recent Sunday morning, about 40 followers gathered for a service of meditation, songs, and readings at the Self-Realization Fellowship's new chapel in South Kansas City. The SRF prefers that services not be recorded or photographed, so we're listening to a recording of the group's religious music. Front and center on the main altar are two pictures, one of Jesus and one of Krishna, representing an ideology that combines Christ's teachings and Hindu yogic practice. The walls of the center are decorated with pictures of the SRF's other important figures, among these portraits of real and mythical saints and gurus with beards and loincloths. One stands out. It features the smiling face of a white Kansas City businessman, the late James J. Lynn.
We've actually had people that have come all the way from India to visit his burial site here in Kansas City. So amongst some devotees in the world of yoga and meditation and SRF, he is considered a modern-day saint.
That's Doug Couch. He and several members of the local Self-Realization Fellowship have been working to uncover the lost history of James J. Lynn. In January of 1932, an ad in the Star announced that an Indian Swami would be speaking for several nights at the Athenaeum in Kansas City. Paramahansa Yogananda's lectures on Indian spirituality had become a nationwide sensation, and on the second night of his Kansas City appearance, millionaire businessman James J. Lynn came to see what the excitement was about. According to Doug Couch, James Lynn later wrote that this evening changed his life.
Yogananda gave brief instructions on how to sit properly for meditation, sit upright and sit very still, and James Lynn said for the first time in his life he realized that his hands were completely still and that he was sitting completely still, and he thought this was a miracle because he was always fidgeting all the time. And he looked up at the stage and Yogananda was looking right at him, and he could see light all around the stage, and he knew that he'd found his spiritual teacher at that point.
James Lynn made his fortune in insurance as head of both Lumberman's Underwriting Alliance and Universal Underwriters. He also had major interests in oil and citrus fruit. But at age 40, after meeting Yogananda and taking up SRF practice, Lynn's life found a new focus.
Every morning when he would go to work in downtown Kansas City, he would have long periods of meditation in his office, and his secretary was instructed to tell people that he was in conference.
James Lynn became close friends with Paramahansa Yogananda and one of the guru's greatest disciples. The SRF teaches that through meditation, it's possible for a person to attain union with God. While this can typically take several lifetimes, James Lynn seems to have achieved it almost instantly. As member Randy Wolf explains, that's why he's referred to in SRF circles as Saint Lynn.
He became a complete saint in the traditional Indian definition of the term. In India, a saint is held to be someone who has achieved complete union with God. And James Lynn accomplished that in his life. And Yogananda said that his business accomplishments will soon be forgotten, but that his spiritual accomplishments will be remembered for hundreds or thousands of years.
James Lynn started as kind of a weekend warrior, keeping his business and spiritual lives separate. But as he got older, Lynn spent more and more of his time with the SRF and eventually turned his business operations over to nephew Eugene in 1946. When Paramahansa Yogananda died in 1952, James Lynn became head of the worldwide religious organization, though he declined to take over as guru. Doug Couch explains.
It was quite common when a spiritual leader passed that the spiritual title of guru would pass on to his chief disciple. And there were some that were expecting that James Lynn would be the new guru of SRF. And he stated that no, that was not in the will of God at that time, that Yogananda was the last in line of gurus, and that from then on they would promulgate the teachings, the original teachings of Yogananda, and not change them in any way, but try to keep them pure.
When James Lynn died of pneumonia in 1955, both the Kansas City Star and the Times wrote extensive front-page tributes to Lynn, describing his business and philanthropic achievements. He had donated the Epperson House to UMKC and created a scholarship fund for the school. Lynn also donated a substantial addition of land to Swope Park, and he had given $1 million in railroad stock to the SRF. The Self-Realization Fellowship experienced a renaissance in the Aquarian years of the 1960s and 70s and found a new champion in Beatle George Harrison. The current Kansas City group was also born in this era. It was started in 1978 by Donna Marie Vinney, who's still an active member. Today, the SRF organization incorporates more than 500 temples and centers in more than 50 countries. In these SRF groups throughout the world, James Lynn continues to be revered despite being more or less forgotten in his hometown.
It really is an example of no matter how successful you are in business, unless you name stuff after yourself, no one's ever heard of it. And he didn't, you know, he wasn't interested in naming things after himself. So he's probably, you know, in the future is going to be more widely known as a yogi and as a spiritual figure, and he already is right in this current time.
The Kansas City chapter of the Self-Realization Fellowship opened its first ever center in Kansas City back in November. Members say their new center has been attracting SRF visitors from throughout the Midwest. For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. After the break, a laundromat offers something cultural to do while you're waiting for your clothes to wash and dry. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, the Missouri Senate took another step toward a takeover of Kansas City schools. Kansas City police worried about a possible serial killer. And some Kansas legislators were hopping mad over a court order to spend more on schools. Steve Bell looks back at those and other top stories on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
Indignant over a court ruling ordering the legislature to spend more on schools, Kansas lawmakers proposed a constitutional amendment. It would strip the courts of any say-so on that. Republican Senator Greg Smith of Overland Park protested.
Where's the hard data that shows me if we spend $4,492 on every single kid in the state of Kansas, they're all going to pass and have a great education?
The figure was partly based on a study ordered by the legislature. On that, Kansas City Democrat Pat Petty commented.
Sometimes we tend to question when the results don't come out the way we want.
Governor Sam Brownback asked the state Supreme Court to appoint a mediator to settle the latest funding dispute. Debate on Governor Brownback's tax cut package was delayed because of an error that resulted in the hearings not being publicized correctly. And committee chair Les Donovan said lawmakers probably needed the extra time.
There's still a lot of parts that aren't bolted down tightly here. We need to make sure that we get these all in place and get everybody comfortable with it.
Two matters still not bolted down tightly are whether to extend a temporary state sales tax and whether to end tax deductions for mortgage interest. With revenues up, Missouri Governor Jay Nixon restored $8.5 million higher education dollars and proposed a $34 million increase for colleges and universities allocated on a performance-based model. Nixon also continued to pitch a reluctant legislature to expand Medicaid.
It is the smart thing to do, and it's the right thing to do.
One proposed Missouri constitutional amendment involved voter photo ID. Black Caucus Chair Jamila Nasheed said it's hypocritical for Republicans to push for more proof of eligibility to vote while opposing background checks for gun purchases.
Here we go again. We know that there hasn't been any signs of voter fraud and voter suppression here in the state of Missouri. So why are we dealing with this time and time again, year after year after year?
Another Missouri amendment proposal would create a 1 cent sales tax for roads and bridges. Sponsor Mike Kehoe says the tax would not apply to groceries, gasoline, or prescription medication, and
as a legislative body, we'll not raise the gas tax. We will not toll existing roads. MoDOT's done their part. They've tightened their belt to make sure their department is running as efficiently as it possibly can. And now I think it's our turn.
The Missouri House passed a bill restoring some tax credit programs for donations to certain nonprofit organizations. The Senate sent the House a bill to make it possible for the state to take over the Kansas City School District without a two-year waiting period. A teenage boy found handcuffed in a Kansas City basement told rescuers his father had kept him there for months, feeding him oatmeal and ramen noodles. Clay County Prosecutor Jim Roberts said charges may be filed, but not prematurely.
One of the things we're looking at is a proper interview of the victim and a review of all the facts as determined by the police department.
The boy was placed with a foster family. Wrapping up the week, Kansas City police worried that there might be a serial killer of Independence Avenue prostitutes at work. And the new Chicago owner of the Board of Trade announced that the last day of Kansas City floor trading for the 150-year-old institution will be June 28th. This is KCUR.
This summer, for the first time since 1856, wheat will no longer be traded here in Kansas City. The CME Group bought the Kansas City Board of Trade last October, and last week, the company announced it would move all wheat trading to Chicago, starting in July. Kansas City was once a capital of the plains, but technology has chipped away at our importance, as Harvest Public Media's Jeremy Bernfeld reports.
That's what it used to sound like at the Kansas City Board of Trade in 2008. Traders standing around the pits shouting orders, making those crazy hand signals you've seen in the movies. Now, most trading is done on the computer. It sounds like this.
So really all I do is the system makes a sound. That's an order going in.
Joe Barker buys and sells contracts on the exchange for hard red winter wheat, the kind of wheat used to make bread. He's the branch manager of CHS Hedging, and his office is in the same building as the Board of Trade. But Barker does almost all of his trading electronically.
That's made us more efficient. We can handle more customers. Their margins get better because we're able to charge them less.
Barker says about 80% of his branch's trades were completed on the floor of the exchange just 5 years ago. Now it's less than 5%. That's the way the industry has been moving. Over the last decade, exchanges in Chicago, New York, and Minneapolis have all closed or merged with larger exchanges. CME Group says June 28th will be the last day for trading wheat in person in Kansas City.
For 157 years, the Kansas City Board of Trade was an integral part of the community.
That's Michael Browdy. He was president of the Board of Trade for 17 years.
Yeah, I used to tell people when I would take them and give them a tour of the floor that it was the place in Kansas City where more money changed hands than any place else.
By the fall, that money will skip Kansas City and flow from computer to computer in nanoseconds. And, as Browdy says, it's not as if the trading pits at the Board of Trade are very rowdy right now.
So what's that like to walk in and just have, you know, one trader in the pit?
Very few people in the pit. It's like walking into a ghost town.
That ghost town used to be crowded, and crowded with influence in Kansas City.
Some of the famous names in our community, Kemper, Latshaw, Ullman, those names were all names of people that were chairman of the Kansas City Board of Trade. To see that kind of a piece of history disappear is very depressing to me.
The grain industry is a bedrock for cities throughout the Midwest. I mean, this season, farmers are expected to produce over 1 billion bushels of the kind of wheat traded in Kansas City. That's not going away. But losing the Kansas City Board of Trade is emblematic of a heartland landscape in flux. Consolidation is a familiar theme for farmers across the country, and it's happening in agribusiness, too. In this case, Chicago benefits, thanks to the CME Group, whose trading floors will still feature in-person wheat trading.
Well, we like to think that what we've just done is combined 150 years of Kansas City history with 150 years of Chicago history.
That's Tim Andreessen, the executive in charge of agricultural investments at CME Group. He says it's all indicative of the agriculture industry getting more and more efficient. Farmers used to be connected to the markets through a game of telephone. A farmer would have to call his broker. He would call his man at the Board of Trade, who would call his guy on the trading floor, and he would actually place the trade. Now, farmers can log on from home or even their iPhone and check in on the markets.
Agriculture is constantly changing, whether it's the production side or the risk management side. I think that what you will continue to see is a progression in all elements of agriculture in terms of being able to deliver value to the customer.
And for now, that progression has left Kansas City without a piece of its history. Jeremy Bernfeld, Harvest Public Media.
Over the next 6 months, a quiet Midtown laundromat will be transformed into a venue for a series of arts events. It's an experiment in more ways than one, as KCUR's Laura Spencer reports.
Inside the Walnut Place laundromat at 43rd and Walnut, a sloping entryway leads to a landing overlooking rows of washers and dryers. There's a circle of chairs and a patterned red rug. The owner introduces himself as Wally and offers a cup of coffee.
My name is Wally Badijo.
Wally Badijo is from Nigeria and moved to Kansas City to attend school. When he's not greeting customers here, he's at his job as a clinical scientist doing diagnostic testing. He says the laundromat is a public place as well as a family business, and they try to make it open and friendly.
I am a two-way street person in thinking, in the sense that, if you started thinking in a one-way fashion, it's more or less like me. That thing has been selfish. Whereas if you think in two ways, then what benefit me will benefit you, will benefit somebody else's. And that's the way the world's supposed to be revolving.
Body Joe says that's one of the reasons he opened the door for artist Sean Starowitz to experiment with a new project called Byproduct, the laundromat. Starowitz says Body Joe has already created a sense of community. It's just inviting more people in.
You tap into a specific community, and then you grab another community, and you kind of get this beautiful cross-pollination.
Since graduating from the Kansas City Art Institute in 2010, Starowitz has collaborated on projects like Bread KC, a series of public dinners raising money for artists and art projects, and Speakeasy, a five-week exhibition that included concerts, readings, and workshops. He says in a laundromat, people are waiting for the wash or dry cycle to finish, and he hopes to fill that time with cultural exploration.
A lot of my work is about unexpectedness and also chance and risk taking. And one side of the project is like setting art events in places that are raw. When it's not in this kind of traditional art space, and setting it in a laundromat will be this kind of sense of invitation. You know, you can have dirty laundry and bring it here. Everybody has dirty laundry.
Starowitz has dubbed the programming at the laundromat as Wash, Dry, Fold, a mashup of different genres. The first wash cycle, as he calls it, in the series includes a screening of a short documentary about the final hours of a neighborhood restaurant, The Dry Cycle, poetry from the locally curated A Common Sense reading series. Over the next 6 months, Starowitz envisions classes, conversations, and site-specific projects while attendees do laundry. And food, like this from the chef and owner of The Rieger.
Howard Hanna is going to try to sous vide fish in a washing machine and maybe also use a dryer to pop popcorn. But food will be a big element.
The project is funded by Rocket Grants, a partnership between the Charlotte Street Foundation and the Spencer Museum of Art, focused on public-oriented artwork.
Kansas City is really a great place to stand behind your ideas because people will support them. And you can look across the communities between the arts community, the food community, the music community, the film community. It's really, really exciting to see, and I think it's a really, really great place to be right now. And I just look forward to seeing this thing unfold.
The puns are limitless, and Starowitz says he welcomes them. He's also open to more ideas for the space, like the filmmaker who wants to create a laundromat orchestra based on the sounds, the humming, the beeping of the machines. So stop by, bring your dirty laundry, and expect the unexpected. Laura Spencer, KCUR News.
Byproduct The Laundromat kicked off at the Walnut Place Laundromat in Kansas City, Missouri this weekend. More information and photos inside the laundromat can be found on our website at kcur.org. Just click on Arts and Culture.
Well, we thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter @kcurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with associate producer Alex Smith. Our interns are Zach Lewandowski and Monica Sandretsky. Theme music is by Approach, and I'm Susan Wilson and glad to be back.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.